From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
A couple of ravens have been shouting at each other across the garden each day this spring into summer, and their loud-mouthed antics reminded me of a somewhat less bawdy conversation about crows and ravens that I had a decade ago on the podcast with ornithologist Dr. John Marsluff of the University of Washington, a conversation I want to reprise on today's show. Possessing large brains for their body size, a knack for social networking that requires no internet connection, and keen powers of observation, crows and ravens are among the big personalities of the bird world. They're also what Dr. Marsluff calls black-feathered practitioners of lifelong learning, and from him I learned about the capacity of their avian brains and the range of things it allows them to do, from the funny to the daring, much of it almost unbelievable. More in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Dr. John Marsluff is a renowned ornithologist and urban ecologist and professor emeritus of wildlife sciences at the University of Washington. He's author of a number of books, including ones about his area of particular expertise, the corvids, crows, ravens, jays, and their relatives. Around the time that we recorded this conversation, I had just read the book he created in collaboration with illustrator Tony Angel called Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans, which was the subject of our discussion.
So welcome back to Away to Garden, John Marsluff. Nice to have you again.
Thank you, Margaret. Appreciate it.
Yes. You know, it's funny. It's been raining here. We haven't had much rain in the Northeast. And I know you've been having crazy in the Pacific Northwest, yeah?
It is very wet.
And looking out the window today, I was thinking, how do birds stay dry anyway in all this rain? Because there they are, and they're all out there. There's always a question about the birds. You know, I have infinite numbers of questions about them.
Well, they've got, fortunately, really nice oil glands, and they just kind of coat themselves with a sheen of oil, and most of the rain just beads right off of their back and rolls off.
Smart birds, or well-built birds, I guess, huh?
Exactly.
So the corvids, the crows, the ravens, et cetera, I love these birds, and I really consider it, as I think many people do, a treat when a flock of crows come calling, or in the winter, sometimes in the snow, I see the big footprints of, I think, a raven, because I sometimes have a raven who wanders around. And so I guess we have to ask the sort of boring question first, who's who, how do we tell them apart?
Between crows and ravens?
Yeah.
Well, the raven is a much bigger cousin of the crow. They're in the same genus, so they are closely related and share a lot of characteristics because of that. But the voice is the easiest characteristic. If you can hear them, the crow is mainly going to caw, and the raven is going to quirk and drip like a faucet and bark like a dog and make lots of other sorts of noises. Being about twice the size, having a 4-foot wingspan, the raven really kind of dwarfs the crow when you see him side by side.
Mm-hmm.
Its tail is also more shaped like a diamond, and it's got more of a beard around its throat from its kind of lanceolate feathers there.
I feel sometimes like I see crows in numbers and ravens maybe onesies and twosies. Is that just an assumption that's incorrect, or is that a characteristic?
No. I think that's quite characteristic. Ravens and crows both mate and form monogamous, lifelong pair bonds. But the raven quickly kicks its kids out of the territory, and the pair patrols that territory.
Oh.
And so you typically just see the pair.
So is the raven our largest songbird? Is that right? Do I have that right?
It's the largest songbird in the world, yes.
Technically,
it's a songbird because of complex throat musculature that it has.
Mm-hmm. So it has a syrinx, yeah? Is that right? It has
that, all birds have a syrinx.
All birds
That's just
do.
The
oh, okay.
kind of the junction box there between the two branches of the bronchi that go to the lungs, and it's where the voice is produced. But the thing that the songbirds have that the others don't are very complex muscles that wrap around that syrinx so that it can warp and pull and stretch in many ways and make such a variable amount of noise.
Interesting. So the subheading of the book that I just enjoyed so much reading, Gifts of the Crow, reads, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. And I thought it was a great subhead, by the way. But a number of times as I was reading the book, I was flashing on a National Geographic series from a few years ago called Monkey Thieves, about these troops of, I don't know if you've ever seen it, rhesus macaque monkeys in India, in Jaipur. And I was thinking, boy, these corvids remind me of those monkeys. And then in the book, a few times, you note, you and your co-author note, that several aspects of avian cognition seen in these birds were things scientists thought for a long time only humans and some monkeys possessed. Could we talk about a few of those, like insight, for instance? Yeah?
Sure. I mean, insight is always been one of the hallmarks of primates. And the idea here then is that you can look at a problem and intuit the solution, basically see the steps that are required to solve this problem. So imagine food hanging from a string or buried in a tube that you can't reach.
Mm.
You might start thinking, oh, how could I position that tube, or could I use a tool to get at that food that's in there? And monkeys, of course, will solve that problem, but crows do as well. And depending on the species, some like the New Caledonia crow, they would fashion a tool to get that food out. And they do it almost instantly when they see the problem. Others might drop things into water to raise the level to float food up to them, or use other sorts of kind of advanced techniques to get at the solution to a problem.
It's amazing. And they, you also say in the book that they can be observers of body language and the intent of others, of other individuals and other creatures, yes?
Absolutely. We did some experiments here with our American crows that live in Seattle, and they're quite tame here. You can typically get very close to them in the city. But if you lunge at them, or even if you just look at them as you approach, they are completely different bird. They'll stand away. They'll move away. They understand that you're paying them some attention, and therefore, you know, it may be good or it may be bad, but they're not going to take the risk.
Until the 1960s, you write, the birds were regarded as simpletons by scientists, you say. And that expression, bird brain, sort of held. Yep. You don't think bird brain is a slur, do you?
It's a compliment of
yeah.
the highest order, for sure.
Yeah. So especially in species, their brains, in some of the corvids, their brains are particularly large for their body size. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and it's important to understand that it is relative to their body size.
Yeah.
So, you know, the brain of a crow is about the size of your thumb, but the bird only weighs, you know, less than a pound. So it's a large brain relative to its body size, and compare it to something like an ostrich is the other extreme for a bird. Very small brain for a big body. Probably not the brightest bird that's out there. But crows and ravens, their brains are much more, for their body size, on line with what we would consider some of the small monkeys to have. So they're really more like a primate in terms of the amount of brain power that they can bring to a problem.
So now mammals and birds both trace back to the same reptilian brains, yes? Is that we have a common ancestry? Is that correct?
That's true. That's the one point we try to make in the book is that some of the things you see and how you interpret them do seem fantastic, but it all comes back to the similarity we have in not only our brains, but the particular nerve cells in the brains, the transmitters that allow us to communicate between nerve cells in the brain and form complex memories. That all goes back to this reptilian heritage that mammals and reptiles and birds all share.
It's so interesting. Does diet have to do with how developed certain of the corvids' brains have become? I mean, is there choice of food, or, you know, because, I mean, you know, we think to to, you know, healthy brain, and I would imagine over time a larger brain, a more functional brain. Is diet involved? Because, boy, these they love food, don't they?
it's involved, and they'll do anything to get it, food. But I think it's almost to flip that around a bit. Because they have a large brain, they also have to capture a lot of energy every day. So they've got to have a high-quality diet, or at least a lot of whatever they're eating. Because the brain's the most expensive organ in the body for us, as well as any other vertebrate. It takes a ton of energy, and when you have a big one, you're sacrificing the need to do other things instead of getting food. You're sacrificing that and trading it off with the ability to do things very efficiently with that brain.
So we're talking about crows and we're talking about ravens, and there are some other relatives like the jays, for instance. Do they have similar diets, or are there distinctive things? I mean, some don't eat certain things.
They're very different. I would say that within the corvids in general, and there's about 140 species there, some are extreme specialists. The pinyon jay, for example, eats primarily pine seeds, and it stores pine seeds throughout the fall to fuel its economy all winter and spring. And then other birds, like the raven, are very general. They'll eat anything that moves or you know, lies around too long. They're going to eat it. So some are very flexible in diet and others very specialized. But the interesting thing is that specialization has driven some parts of the brain of these birds to be incredible, like the pinyon jay I mentioned, has to remember where it puts all these seeds. And so it has a very large hippocampus, part of its brain that's responsible for spatial memory.
Oh.
The raven has got to solve lots of different problems and figure lots of different foods out, and it has a large general forebrain.
Huh. You know, you write in the book, Gifts of the Crow, you write that everyone has a crow story. And I suspect when you go to cocktail parties or whatever, everyone wants to tell you their crow stories, yes? Is that?
Yes.
And, of course, I do. But instead of telling you a crow story, I have a lot of blue jays, not an uncommon bird where I live in the Northeast. And there's a lot in my garden in a rural spot. And because one of my peculiarities among many is because sort of nature always cleans its plate, I don't like to waste anything. So when I have mice in a trap in the cellar or the barn or the shed, I just put them outside. And, you know, by the next morning, it's always gone. Usually someone takes it away, and I figure I fed somebody. Well, the other day, I tossed one out onto the unfrozen lawn. And within about 3 minutes, I went in, and I turned my head, something caught my eye, and it was a blue jay. And it was, I don't know how to tell a he from a she so well with blue jays, but it sort of stabbed at it. Picked it, pushed it around, stabbed at it, tried to figure out how to get a hold of it, and then lifted off and left with it. I mean, within minutes of my putting it there. Now, I had no idea. So some of these birds are carrion eaters or omnivores, or I don't know what specifically we would say. Yes?
Yes, I would say even the most specialized seed eaters, and the blue jay is towards that line. It specializes on acorns for the most part.
Yes.
But even those that are specialized in the corvids, they'll always take matter like that. They'll take a small mouse, a small bird, an egg, a small snake or frog. They will always take those. Again, kind of getting back to your first point about the quality of the diet, and that's high energy, high protein and fat that's coming in with a small animal like that really helps them meet their energetic needs.
Last winter, I saw a first with the blue jays again. They pecked the latex paint off my front porch very systematically and would disappear with pieces of paint and eggshells as well. I put out eggshells, and they would just, within a moment, they would pick them up and fly away with them, every eggshell.
Sure.
Yeah. Now, so do some of the blue jays have a crop where they can cache things. Is that correct? They have like a pouch-like structure, do they? Can they?
The blue jays got what we call just an expandable throat.
Expandable throat.
It can hold
a
couple of acorns.
Oh.
When you get into something like the Clark's Nutcracker, they have a special pouch that's a space under their tongue that opens up almost like a pelican's pouch. And they can put 150 or so pine seeds in that thing.
Wow.
And fly off with it. So within the corvids, you see these different sorts of adaptations to their special way of life. And again, the blue jay is more general, and therefore it hasn't committed all the way to the throat pouch, but it's certainly got some elasticity there to help out carry a big load for sure.
So the informal verb rook, like to rook somebody, means to take money from someone by like fooling them or cheating them, but it's also the name of a species of corvid, and I assume that's no coincidence, right?
I think it's definitely related, yeah.
There's a chapter in the book called Delinquency, so I think they're it's related. So I want to talk about that a little.
Yeah, the rook is a rather large corvid, kind of halfway between a raven and a crow in size, that lives in northern Europe. And it's closely tied to agricultural lands. It probes around for worms for the most part. But they are very keen on getting food and hiding it and keeping it hidden from others. They try to deceive others in terms of where they put food for later use. And I would guess that they probably stole things that were laying around the farm, not just plants, but shiny things as well. And, and that might have led to that saying for sure.
Yeah. So there's, as I said, there's a chapter in the book called Delinquency, and there's a wonderful anecdote about windshield wipers. So I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit about that, about delinquent crows.
And it's not an isolated incident. The interesting thing is that evidently corvids have a bit of a penchant for windshield wipers all around the world. But out here in the Northern Cascades, I got a call one day from the National Park Service that was concerned with campers there because they were having their windshield wipers stolen while they were hiking or sleeping, and they were afraid that people would have an accident if they got in their car and didn't realize their wipers were gone and hit a rainy day like today. And they figured out that it was a raven that was stealing these windshield wipers, and they had no idea why or how many birds were involved in all of this. So my daughter and I went up there to start catching the ravens and tagging them and seeing who was participating and maybe figuring out why they were doing this. And long story short, it was a pair of ravens that lived right around this visitor center that was the culprit. And the folks in the park had already named it Hitchcock. And they were concerned, again, with the damage it was doing. So we tried to use its big brain to our advantage, and we captured the bird, Hitchcock and his mate. And we captured them in a parking lot where cars typically are vulnerable to having their windshield wipers taken. And we banded the bird right on a windshield. So that's an uncomfortable thing for a raven. They're being held by us. Typically, we try to be as calm and keep the bird as in the dark as possible. But we didn't this time. We let him look full on at the windshield wiper the entire time. We were measuring him and putting a band on his leg and tagging him for our scientific use later, and then we let him go. But we hoped that he would form a complex memory of that bad thing, a guy holding me and looking at a windshield wiper and being in this area, and stop messing with windshield wipers from then on. And indeed, the behavior declined. It doesn't occur now at all, and those birds are still around. So we've been able to utilize the bird's intellect to teach it what's not acceptable in this setting, and allow the bird to live there and keep other ravens who might pick up the habit from coming in as well. Because the other alternative was just to kill the bird and remove it.
And
but
people,
rather than
yeah,
that, we...
Yeah, people do that. I mean, people get infuriated with birds and do destroy them, and it's, yeah.
There are other solutions for sure, and this was an example.
Yeah. You said the birds are still there. How long do crows or ravens, what's their lifespan?
Well, the longest on record, really, are somewhere in the 15 to 20-year range because, you have to have a bird banded that long to follow it and really know its exact age. But if you do the calculations based upon their annual rate of mortality, which is very low, less than 5%, certainly there are some birds out there that are 20, 30, maybe even 40 years old in the wild.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Now, you said with the windshield wiper kleptomania, you said that was, it's not just that one incident, that it's in many places that's been.
And it's been reported in several national parks in the West. It's been reported in Australia with a different species there. And for some reason, these birds really like rubber. It's maybe the pliable nature is kind of like an animal skin, and they tug at it, and that's something that they find possibly leading to food or interesting or stimulating to touch. We're not really sure why they do it.
Huh. I'm always wowed by stories about crows' ability for facial recognition, and I wanted to talk about Dick Cheney for a moment. Can you tell us your Dick Cheney story?
Sure. This is funny. It was an experiment that we devised because whenever we studied the birds around here, we climbed to their nest to band their babies, or we'd catch them, like I described with the raven, to tag them so we could follow them. And we always kind of felt that the birds knew us after that. They acted differently around us. Mm-hmm. Some were more aggressive. Some were more cautious around us after we had watched them a while. So we thought we would test that idea directly. And the idea we had was to catch a few birds, and we catch them by shooting a net over them. And so that's a scary situation again. And when we ran up to get the birds out of the net to band them and tag them, we wore a particular mask. And in our case, the dangerous guy, the trapper in this case, wore a caveman's face. And so the birds, as they were having this difficult experience with us, they were looking at a caveman the entire time. And our idea was then anybody could wear this caveman mask later and walk through where we had caught birds, and we could see if those birds would really respond differently. And
right.
It wasn't just us thinking that, because anybody could do it. And we also wanted to compare the reaction to us wearing a different mask. And that's where the Dick Cheney comes in.
Right.
Because Dick was the vice president at that time, and his mask was on sale on the internet, so I got a couple. And we now walk around campus either as Dick Cheney or a caveman and see if the birds can tell us apart.
And they can, and, yes.
And they can,
yeah.
And they have been for 9 years now. So this is an example of not only fine discrimination to tell those two apart, but also social learning, in that birds that are able to tell those masks apart now weren't even born when the caveman did anything wrong. And they've learned from seeing others who were around demonstrate that this guy is bad.
Wow. So we have a couple minutes left, but besides being gifted in these ways we've been talking about, crows are inclined to give gifts. You mentioned shiny objects before. Have you ever received any yourself?
Personally, I have never gotten a gift from a crow.
Oh.
Probably because I do more scary things to them than pleasant things to them. But I've been gifted by learning about these treasures that other people get, for sure. And I have seen many of these treasures, and I've seen video of the birds holding these things now. And what it looks like are fairly young birds, probably, or perhaps birds that don't have a mate that are courting a human in this case, really, as a social partner. Maybe a mate, but at least as a social partner. And they give things like trinkets from lockets or necklaces or keys or pencil erasers or shiny rocks and pieces of glass are very common that people get. And it happens where either somebody's done a crow a really good deed, like free it from a trap, or where they've been feeding them consistently.
I love it. I love it. I love your work. I love your books. John Marsliff, ornithologist, corvid expert from the University of Washington. I'm so glad you could join me again today and tell us a little bit about the gifts of the crow. Thank you. I hope to speak to you again soon.
Thanks a lot, Margaret. I appreciate it.
Okay. And it's good to speak to all the rest of you, of course, every week. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at facebook.com/awaytogarden or on the website, awaytogarden.com. And happy bird watching meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.